Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today I'm very pleased to have a guest, Anna Harvey. Anna is a senior lecturer at the Tavistock and Portman Clinic. She teaches on the professional doctorate in social work. Anna has 27 years of experience in child protection and social care, and she leads modules on psychosocial interventions and integrates psychoanalytic and ecological perspectives. Anna's awareness of the ecological crisis led to her organising a climate psychology conference and subsequent journal special edition, and she incorporates ecological metaphors into all of her work to help students understand the complexity, adaption and systemic interconnections. Personally, she home educates her son in ecology. Anna, we're very proud to have you on Edgy Ideas. How are you today and where are you?
I'm very good, thank you. I'm actually in the Alps. So I live a part-time in France, near the Swiss border, just a bit south of Lac Le Mans. And I live part-time in London where I work. So yes, I'm joining you here from the mountains.
Lovely. Sounds lovely. I must come and visit one day.
Definitely.
That sounds beautiful. So we're going to talk today. Your thinking around ecology is really important, and you come from a psychoanalytic background as well. So
yeah,
let's start by sort of inquiring, how do these two things come together for you? What's the importance of bringing the psychosocial with the ecology together?
Yeah, well, I suppose I was a social work practitioner for many years, and then undertook a doctorate in social work and social care from an emotional well-being perspective, bringing in ideas of the unconscious. So I developed quite an interest in psychoanalysis. I went into psychoanalysis for 10 years because of my own very disturbed childhood. I'm not saying after 10 years there was any kind of health after that, but it really did help a lot. So I brought, my personal experience of psychoanalysis, my interest intellectually in psychoanalysis into my social work teaching, and because the course was developed by somebody called Professor Andrew Cooper and Professor Stephen Briggs and Liz Webb, people like Marion Bauer, these old kind of social worky type people who were interested in how psychoanalysis can help us think about the lived experience of social work practice. And then I realized at a certain point, I think it was when COVID was happening, that really, I am a kind of expert in child protection. And I've written about reflective practice for child protection from in-depth psychoanalytic perspective. But really, I think there's a point at some point in your psychoanalytic journey that you realize the internal is only shaped by the external, that you're within a much wider context. And then I realized that, what's the point of doing child protection when there are greater risks for children, around the world, so I became very interested in the sociological, which is a part of the psychosocial approach. I don't think there are any individuals, really. I think everybody's within their group or their context, their community, and this wider socio-political field. So we can only understand child protection, I think, from a much wider perspective. And yeah, I'm much more favouring a kind of public health. People, when we come as social workers, go into houses, we're dealing with people who are very marginalized, extremely deprived, almost created by society to hold what is projected into them. Yeah. We thought of child protection from a different perspective, a public health perspective, I think we'd have a much better chance of helping people out of the kind of contexts and environments that they're in, which create the problems of child abuse, etc. So I thought, and obviously with a growing child, I thought it was more and more urgent that I was thinking about the future generations. You know, in Wales, they've got this Future Generation, the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act. And I became interested in the fact that really we should be thinking about, you know, child protection is a very narrow field, and we should be thinking much more widely about why certain difficulties occur in society. So yeah.
So you like me, I mean, I was a family therapist in Liverpool, and it was in the 1980s, I was doing that, 1990s, and it was deprivation like I'd never seen in my life. You know, I came from a working class Bristol background, but this was something different. This is the levels of deprivation, it was excessive, and it was kind of post-Thatcherism, post-industrialization. And I started off seeing individuals, and I realized that you needed to look at the family system, not just the individual. Yeah. And then I realized you needed to look at the police and the social services and the education. Yeah. And then I kind of thought, well, this, you know, a lot of this problem is an economic political problem, actually.
Exactly. Like, you know,
this underpins this. And I kind of got burnt out, Ben, and I left. And like you, I mean, you described kind of the circles of sociology, but you go beyond that as well now, don't you? You've stepped into the world of the environmentalist and the ecology. Do you want to say something about this wider ecological perspective?
Well, at a certain point, psychoanalysis feels very, it almost becomes a religion when you're thinking about it day in, day out. And I felt a little bit suffocated and enclosed or something.
Yeah.
You know, and everything became rarefied. You know, I know Kleinian theory, object theories, you know, coming out of my, whatever. Yeah, it's, you know, at a certain point, you kind of think, you know, there are cultural, well, my husband is an artist, so he's always talking to me about cultural theory. So that was really inspiring. And also, you know, in terms of a personal journey, we were considering, we had friends, we in living in Stroud. It's a, you know, it's quite an alternative village,
hippie culture.
Everybody was going off to Wales to become a permaculturists. You know, they were starting little small holdings.
Yeah.
And we visited our friends over there and really seriously considered buying a piece of plot of land with the community and building a little permaculture group. So I really became kind of involved in ecology. You know, I've always loved nature, whatever that means out there. You know, I've always loved the science of biology. And then I started to develop an interest in permaculture ideas, and more just became like a real, this is reality. Ecology is reality.
Yeah.
You know, it's a way, it's a lens of seeing the world that takes in all of the different levels of the system. So, you know, yes, you've got your internal world, you know, your internal world, which the psychoanalytic stuff kind of looks at, but that is only, you only internalize what is external, what is you're around you.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's a dynamic interplay, obviously. It's not that simple. We're not a reflection of the world around us. But I was really interested in looking wider at the, you know, thinking in terms of ecology, thinking in terms of some permaculture concepts, thinking about you start local, you know, you think about diversity, you think about you kind of the ecosystem around you, the interconnections, you observe, you know, in my kind of psychoanalytic social work training, I did an infant observation for 9 months where I learned to be an observer. And then I undertook an institutional observation where I looked at the organization from an observational perspective. And with permaculture, you're supposed to observe kind of before making any decision about your garden, etc. And your diversity creates, your diversity in the garden creates strength, and, you know, it helps plants flourish. You know, I could see how, you know, and social work's always been a bit ecological, you know, it's we've always had Bronfenfenner, you'll need to thingamabob that one. So you know, he talked about, you know, the child within the wider system. So in social work, it's kind of a, it's an accepted idea anyway, that we have these different levels of the system which interact with each other. So it just, it seemed that ecology could help me think a bit differently about problems. It was also a particular foil to the kind of narrative, the kind of ideology that is involved in social work practice at the moment, which is quite linear, quite technical, rational. If we only follow the procedures, everything will be fine. Social workers are inundated with a myriad of tasks doing, and we never stop and think. We don't, you know,
no, I mean, I find, in terms of social work, when I was a family therapist, I worked with clinicians from all, you know, psychologists, social workers, doctors, medics. And social workers seemed to almost have an impossible task. It was, I kind of thought, used to think of it as a bit of an impossible profession. They were damned if they do, damned if they don't. And there was like just increasingly regulations. And the social workers came into it because they wanted to kind of think about people within society and how they could kind of help. But actually, they became kind of instrumentalized. They became the system instrumentalized the social work profession.
Yeah.
And it made it like an impossible profession. And I think that's also true of psychoanalysis in many forms. You know, I was on the couch yesterday. I'm still on the couch. I still do the work. It's vitally important to my work. And yet it can become cultish depending on what brand you have. If you're a Kleinian or a Tav, or if you're a Lacanian, or they split off into their little cults, and they can become quite inward looking, and they can become very human focused. And I'm the Leadership Institute's very interested in the human and the non-human.
Yeah.
You know, because we almost like limit ourselves as if we are still gods, you know, as if we're still kind of the center of the universe, the top of the pyramid. I think this really needs a radical review.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair to my psychoanalyst, he was a Kleinian, but very broad-minded. It was like, you're taking oxygen. It was a foil to, it became more and more kind of religious and ideological in my work environment. But my psychoanalysis itself helped me to breathe a little bit. And, you know, we did look much more widely at the world. So it wasn't too dogmatic. So I had a very, and this idea of your ego, it's nice to put it in its place. It's a, you know, if you have your if you're concerned about your ego, everything becomes about that. You know, I could be here, could be really worried about being self-conscious, thinking about my ego, not thinking about the audience, not thinking about my relationship to you, and what my students might think when they listen to the, you know, we're tiny cogs, and that's the best thing about ecology, I think, isn't it? I was teaching Idris about archaea. We didn't know anything about archaea last week, and, you know, that we've got bacteria next week, you know, billions and billions of microbes. They probably began, you know, 4 years ago. You know, life is, these time frames and these quantities really are, we're so small within the context of the world. Basically, we are, you know, and then obviously if you went into the universe or even, I wouldn't say we're irrelevant, but we are pretty very, very, very tiny, tiny part of the world. You know, people like Trump.
And the other thing ecology teaches us is,
you know, that nothing.
The other thing ecology teaches us, it decenters us. It's like,
yeah,
in a very powerful way, I find, and also in a way which is quite difficult to embody, because we're so used to being person-centric, you know, person-centered counseling, individualistic, hyper-individualistic, as you say. And ecology kind of decenters you, and I like Donna Haraway's work. She talks about symbiosis. Like when I was doing systems theory and stuff at the TAF, we talked about kind of autopoiesis and Haraway says that nothing makes itself. Nothing makes itself, and like every all the microbiology within ourselves, in our digestive systems, on our skin, we cannot operate without the other, without the other within us, without the other outside of us. And she talks about symbiosis, like making with, that everything is made with something else.
And
I think this is vital from a political point of view, from a personal point of view. I think this is one of the big lessons we have to kind of learn as a human race.
Yes, absolutely. And, if you look at ecology and the ecological thinkers, some of the scientists, traditionally competition has been privileged as a concept, which we've then kind of taken on. But actually, symbiosis, mutualism, these are the realities of life. We in our gut, we have a huge amount of organisms in there. We are part of, we're part of the system. We're part of the earth. We're part of, we've got biotic and abiotic factors. Where gravity is, kind of operating on all of us, in terms of wider systems, the sunlight, the pull of the moon, the gravitational pulls, these are all systems. We're part of these systems and we're part of a process. So we do obviously get born, we're conceived, we get born and we die, but that's just a process. It's a long process. We're not objects, we're not individuals, we're not separate from the environment. That we are not separate from nature. We are nature. It's within us. We are organic compounds. We're lipids and a whole host of things.
I'm interested in Indigenous thinking, First Nations thinking, and we've had Michelle McMahon on this program, on this podcast, and she talked about time and ancestors as well. And of course, the Indigenous people think with their ancestors. They think not only with their ancestors, but they think with their future grandchildren.
Yeah,
I think this is very interesting that actually, like just from a biological kind of perspective, from a genetic perspective, our ancestors are with us. They're part of our bodies. They're part of our kind of physical makeup, let alone our psychological and spiritual makeup.
Yes. So I've been learning a lot about that in, kind of teach Idris about natural history and thinking about thinking about eukaryotes. And then how did, for 3.5 to 2.7 billion years, we were these very simple life forms and then became complex life forms because all of these things came together, and capacity for greater energy consumption, etc., reproduction. You've got this concept of Luca, the most original, we're all descended from. So we've all got this genetic material. We're all involved in the past. I think with Indigenous knowledge, we're very privileged to have people watching over the land, and to Africa to visit a friend when I was much younger, and she was working with Indigenous leaders in Ghana, and they being the sacred. So she tried to help them think about their, their spiritual, how important these sacred forests were. They're not just, ecologically, they're very interesting, phenomenon, but they do have, in African cultures, a lot of nature or have the ideas of energy and ancestors and the very, very connected to the forest represents these spirits and these ancestors, and it's part they're of this. This is part of them, and so it's there's a connection, isn't there, with the land, with with the history, with the time, with your identity, with how you can think about the world. It creates your possibilities of being in the world, you know, and these are very...
And language is very important in this. It's, you know, if you think about psychoanalysis, object relations, it's the way they talk about projections, the way it's taught is actually quite mechanical. We know we like it's not mechanical, but the way it's kind of taught is like, you know, one object gets projected onto another object and then it gets internalized. It's kind of a transactional kind of language. We know it's not like that in reality. But I'm thinking of in our courses in the Ecolution Institute, we run diplomas in coaching, and we used to send people off to reflect in between sessions, and reflections are kind of a very cognitive process. And now we send people off to compost. So we do composting, and composting means to us, it means moving your body. It means feeding your body. It means going into the cosmos, going outside and allowing your unconscious and your physical body to do some metabolizing, to metabolize the emotions and the thoughts. So it shifts from a cognitive to a kind of a physical, material, spiritual kind of way of being. And then from the composting, you get nutrients. You know, compost produces rich nutrients which feed the soil. And when you do that kind of work, you come back and you kind of feed your thinking, feed your ideas. And it's a different process. Now, I think language is really important, that we start shifting our language away from this sort of cerebral cognitive space into a more kind of physical engaged space.
Yes, where a pedagogy at the Tavistock, where I teach on the doctorate, is based on seminars and reflective circle. You know, I tell all my students to put the pen under the chairs. You know, they're terrified. They've got all of their... When they first start, they have all their gadgets out, you know, on the till. Yeah, and then I'm like, put them away. And we sit together and, you know, and we sit together. And which I think in terms of composting, it's so important. We have all of this experience, don't we? Experience, experience, experience. And then we jump straight to action in some of our professions. It probably happens in nursing. Whatever profession you're in, you're bombarded with experience and you have no time to digest that experience. And then you can't then move on to thinking about the emotional aspects of the experience or analyze what that might mean. And I think composting is about sharing thoughts and ideas and trying to allow a deepening, digging probably some of the topsoil into the nutrients, to get the good stuff to come up. You can put so you've got more fertilized ground to be able to some of these ideas into, like little and you can't do that by yourself. I think you have to be with other people. You have to be with people who have ideas as well. You can all start having a monocrop and thinking the same way.
Yeah, we've seen that, haven't we? Very dominant way of, you know, we're with the technology and society as well. We now have our fishbowls, and these monocrops become more and more like we shut ourselves off. So there's less and less. It's a paradox that the world has become much more interconnected and yet much more kind of separated as well. So, but taking that further, I'm very interested in thinking with symbiosis, thinking with the other, not just a human out there. I mean, I've noticed that, you know, I've for the first time in my life, I have a dog, you know, a pet, and for many reasons, I didn't have one in the past. So now I walk the dog 3 or 4 times a day, it seems. And that thinking with the dog, thinking with nature, like walking on the beach with a dog, it produces a different kind of thinking, a different kind of being than it does if I sit in a circle with just people. And it's quite interesting. And you know, we can't all suddenly become kind of indigenous people with their ways of being. Yeah. But we can, even in our own lives, think about the plants around us, think about the stars above us, think about the animals around us, and notice how we kind of think with these other beings within our ecological systems.
We've got seven, 8 years, And they're, I mean, you know, at the moment, they're very excited because foals are out, you know. You've seen the holes, you can actually see them running around, these bank voles. And so the cats have gone from, you know, being inside, not like really being to go out to hunt. They're just in and out, in and out, in and out. And they're so excited. And we, you know, the cats ask us to feed them in the morning. They then, our routine is we have to go and sit with them on the settee. And they ask us to come and give them cuddles, so we have to sit there. This is how we start our day. We we sit on the settee. We allow them, you know, and talk to us. We see our world through them. It would be mad to be kind of going out with your 6 o'clock in the morning off to school and off to work in a car and running away from these poor little animals. You know, they expect us to be there. It's their routine. You know, we spend at least 45 minutes just being with them. And, you know, it's just different. It's just a different priority, isn't it? It's a, you know, these cats, they do talk to us. I mean, they are very, very communicative and they have a lot of consciousness. They have a
it's very different. Yeah, you're tuning into seasons, tuning into other ways of being, and I think this is so, so vital for us to actually feel. It's not just but a good environment. It's actually to feel whole as a person, to feel holistic, to feel part of a cosmos rather than kind of this. You know, modernity has made us alienated, kind of disenchanted beings. You know, like. The way life is structured, the way the clock is structured, the way we kind of ignore the seasons and just pile on. And these things are kind of made almost to make us kind of alienated. And this, you know, the project at the Ecological Institute at the moment is re-enchanting our worlds. And it's really about bringing the spirit back into our lives. And that means reconnecting. You can't just do it through some cognitive exercise. It's about reconnecting with these wider ecologies.
Yeah, absolutely. Experience has been really hollowed out, hasn't it? And in the art, I used Michael Rosen, one of our huge inspirations. We love him so much. And, you know, taught Idris virtually to read some of Michael Rosen's books. And you talking about Michael this bit, that's my thread a bit. This brilliant joke about this cat, and the cat is this boy, and the boy, one day his parents are so off to work, going to the respective works, that they forget about this boy, and Mr. Tibbs the cat looks after this boy and runs after one of. Just come back, you know, you've forgotten your son. And so they go back and they realize their mistake, and they really feel terrible about it. But it's just like kind of a comment on life. You know, we've forgotten about our children, you know, we've forgotten about children go to school with backpack really heavy, full of books. And you've got to lug it around all day. It's like the world on your shoulders. And then the education is very superficial, very hollowed out. They haven't got time to go out into, well, one more, there are forest schools. Yeah, it's very...
It is. And if you walk into, you know, and that school training is basically training to go into office life or corporate life or business, you know, like the... Organizations I work in are, you know, they work people long, long hours. And this thing called work means looking at a screen, like, you know, it's almost like dehumanizing experience. Like, you know, we really do have to kind of reflect on how we re-engage with the world around us, I think. Anna, we're coming to an end of the podcast, and I asked guests at the end of the podcast two questions. They're big questions, so just any free associations or thoughts you have on what it means to live a good life and what it means to create a good society. Any thoughts?
Different and observes to try and be thinking about future generations, because we're not you, it doesn't matter what we consume, we'll never feel about ourselves, with any kind of consumption. It's about the meaning in our lives that is the thing that will make a good society, recognizing the value of people and the recognizing that actually we are like a community, we are society.
Lovely, Anna, thank you very much for your thoughts. It's been lovely talking to you. Go well.
Nice, thank you.